Jacques Lacan, écrit: aggressiveness in psychoanalysis. Theoretical paper presented in Brussels in mid-May 1948 at the 11th Congress of French-speaking psychoanalysts. The preceding paper presented to you the use I make of the notion of aggressiveness in clinical work and therapy. That notion must now be put to the test before you to determine whether or not we can wrest a concept from it that may lay claim to scientific usefulness. In other words, a concept that can objectify facts that are of a comparable order in reality, or, more categorically, that can establish a dimension of analytic experience in which these objectified facts may be regarded as variables. All of us here at this gathering share an experience based on a technique and a system of concepts to which we are faithful, as much because the system was developed by the man who opened up all of that experience's pathways to us, as because it bears the living mark of its stages of development. In other words, contrary to the dogmatism with which we are taxed, we know that this system remains open as regards both its completion and a number of its articulations. These hiatuses seem to come together in the enigmatic signification Freud expressed with the term death instinct, attesting, rather like the figure of the Sphinx, to the aphoria this great mind encountered in the most profound attempt to date, to formula one of man's experiences in the biological register. This aporia lies at the heart of the notion of aggressiveness, whose role in the psychical economy we appreciate better every day. That is why the question of the metapsychological nature of the deadly tendencies is constantly being raised by our theoretically inclined colleagues, not without contradiction, and often, it must be admitted, in a rather formalistic way. I would simply like to proffer a few remarks or theses inspired by my years of reflection upon this veritable aporia in psychoanalytic doctrine, and by the sense I have, after reading numerous works, for our responsibility for the current evolution of laboratory psychology and psychotherapy. I'm referring, on the one hand, to so-called behaviorist research that seems to me to owe its best results, insignificant as they sometimes appear compared to the sizable theoretical apparatus with which they are framed, to the often implicit use it makes of categories psychoanalysis has contributed to psychology, and on the other hand, to the kind of treatment given to both adults and children that might be placed under the heading of psychodrama, which looks to abreaction for its therapeutic power, trying to exhaust it at the level of role-playing, and to which classical psychoanalysis has, once again, contributed the actual guiding notions. Thesis 1. Aggressiveness manifests itself in an experience that is subjective in its very constitution. It is, in fact, useful to consider the phenomenon of psychoanalytic experience in trying to get at the basics. Reflection upon this is often omitted. It can be said that psychoanalytic action develops in and through verbal communication, that is, in a dialectical grasping of meaning. Thus it presupposes a subject who manifests himself verbally in addressing another subject. It cannot be objected to us that this latter subjectivity must be null and void, according to the ideal physics lives up to, eliminating it by using recording devices, though it cannot avoid responsibility for human error in reading the results. Only a subject can understand a meaning. Conversely, every meaning phenomenon implies a subject. In analysis, a subject presents himself as capable of being understood, and is, in effect, introspection and supposedly projective intuition are not the a priori vitiations that psychology, taking its first steps along the path of science, believe to be irreducible. This would be to create an impasse out of moments that are abstractly isolated from a dialogue. Whereas one should instead trust in its movement, it was to Freud's credit that he assumed the risks involved before overcoming them by means of a rigorous technique. Can his results ground a positive science? Yes, if the experience can be verified by everyone. Now, this experience constituted between two subjects, one of whom plays in the dialogue the role of ideal impersonality, a point that will require explanation later, may, once completed, its only conditions having to do with the capability of this subject, which is something that may be required in all specialized research, be begun anew by the second subject with a third. This apparently initiatory path is simply transmission by recurrence, which should surprise no one since it stems from the very bipolar structure of all subjectivity. Only the speed at which the experience spreads is affected thereby, and while it may be debated whether the experience is restricted to the region in which a specific culture reigns, although no sound anthropology can raise objections on that score, all the indicators suggest that its results can be relativized sufficiently to become generalizable, thus satisfying the humanitarian postulate inseparable from the spirit of science. Thesis 2. Aggressiveness presents itself in analysis as an aggressive intention and as an image of corporeal dislocation, and it is in such forms that it proves to be effective. Analytic experience allows us to experience intentional pressure. We read it in the symbolic meaning of symptoms. Once the subject sheds the defenses by which he disconnects them from their relations with his everyday life and history, in the implicit finality of his behavior and his refusals, in his bungled actions, in the avowal of his favorite fantasies, and in the rebuses of his dream life, we can almost measure it in the demanding tone that sometimes permeates his whole discourse, in his pauses, hesitations, inflections, and slips of the tongue, in the inaccuracies of his narrative, irregularities in his application of the fundamental rule, late arrivals at sessions, calculated absences, and often in his recriminations, reproaches, phantasmatic fears, angry emotional reactions, and displays designed to intimidate. Actual acts of violence are as rare as might be expected given the predicament that led the patient to the doctor and its transformation, accepted by the patient, into a convention of dialogue. The specific effect of this aggressive intention is plain to see. We regularly observe it in the formative action of an individual on those who are dependent upon him. Intentional aggressiveness gnaws away, undermines, and disintegrates. It castrates. It leads to death. And I thought you were impotent, growled a mother with a tiger's cry to her son, who, not without great difficulty, had confessed to her his homosexual tendencies. One could see that her permanent aggressiveness as a virile woman had taken its toll. It has always been impossible in such cases for us to divert the blows of the analytic experience itself. This aggressiveness is, of course, exercised within real constraints, But we know from experience that it is not no less effective when conveyed by one's mien, expressivit, one's mien. I don't know what the fuck that word means. A harsh parent intimidates by his mere presence, and the image of the punisher scarcely needs to be brandished for the child to form such an image. Its effects are more far-reaching than any physical punishment. After the repeated failures encountered by classical psychology in its attempts to account for the mental phenomenon known as images, a term whose expressive value is confirmed by all its semantic acceptations, psychoanalysis proved itself capable of accounting for the concrete reality they represent. That is because it began with their formative function in the subject and revealed that if common images make for certain individual differences in tendencies, they do so as variations of the matrices that other specific images, which in my vocabulary correspond to antiquity's term imago, constitute for the instincts themselves. Among the latter images are some that represent the elective vectors of aggressive intentions, which they provide with an efficacy that might be called magical. These are the images of castration, emasculation, mutilation, dismemberment, dislocation, evisceration, devouring, and bursting open of the body. In short, the imagos that I personally have grouped together under the heading imagos of the fragmented body, a heading that certainly seems to be structural. There is a specific relationship here between man and his own body that is also more generally manifested in a series of social practices, from tattooing, incision, and circumcision rituals in primitive societies to what might be called the Procrustean arbitrariness of fashion, in that it contradicts, in advanced societies, respect for the natural forms of the human body, the idea of which is a latecomer to culture. One need but listen to the stories and games made up 2 or 5 year by 2 or 5 year olds alone or together, to know that pulling off heads and cutting open bellies are spontaneous themes of their imagination, which the experience of a busted up doll merely fulfills. One must take leaf through a book of Hieronymus Bosch's work, including views of whole works as well as details, to see an atlas of all the aggressive images that torment mankind. The prevalence that psychoanalysis has discovered among them of images based on a primitive otoscopy of the oral organs and organs derived from the cloaca is what gives rise to the shape of the demons in Bosch's work. Even the ogee of the Augustia of birth can be found in the gates to the abyss through which they thrust the damned, and even narcissistic structure may be glimpsed in the glass spheres in which the exhausted partners of the garden of earthly delights are held captive. These phantasmagorias crop up constantly in dreams, especially when an analysis appears to reflect off the backdrop of the most archaic fixations. I'll mention here a dream recounted by one of my patients, whose aggressive drives manifested themselves in obsessive fantasies. In the dream, he saw himself in a car with the woman with whom he was having a rather difficult love affair, being pursued by a flying fish whose balloon-like body was so transparent that one could see the horizontal level of liquid it contained, an image of vesicle persecution of great anatomical clarity. These are all basic aspects of a gestalt that is characteristic of aggression in man, and that is tied to both the symbolic character and cruel refinement of the weapons he builds, at least at the artisanal stage of his industry. The imaginary function of this gestalt will be clarified in what follows. Let us note here that to attempt a behaviorist reduction of the analytic process, to which a concern with rigor, quite unjustified in my view, might impel some of us, is to deprive the imaginary function of its most important subjective facts, to which favorite fantasies bear witness in consciousness and which have enabled us to conceptualize the imago, which plays a formative role in identification. Thesis 3. The mainsprings of aggressiveness determine the rationale for analytic technique. Dialogue in itself seems to involve a renunciation of aggressiveness. From Socrates onward, philosophy has always placed its hope in dialogue to make reason triumph. And yet ever since, Thrasymachus made his mad outburst at the beginning of that great dialogue, the Republic, verbal dialectic has all too often proved a failure. I have emphasized that the analyst cures through dialogue, curing cases of madness that are just as serious. But virtue then did Freud add to dialogue? What virtue then did Freud add to dialogue? The rule proposed to the patient in analysis allows him to advance in an intentionality that is blind to any other purpose than that of freeing him from suffering or ignorance of whose very limbs he is unaware. His voice alone will be heard for a period of time whose duration depends on the analyst's discretion. In particular, it will soon become apparent to him, indeed confirmed, that the analyst refrains from responding at the level of giving advice or making plans. This constraint seems to run counter to the desired end, and so must be justified by some profound motive. What then lies behind the analyst's attitude, sitting there as he does across from him? The concern to provide the dialogue with a participant who is as devoid as possible of individual characteristics. We efface ourselves, we leave the field in which the interest, sympathy, and reactions a speaker seeks to find on his interlocutor's face might be seen. We avoid all manifestations of our personal tastes. We conceal whatever might betray them. We depersonalize ourselves and strive to represent to the other an ideal of impassibility. We are not simply expressing thereby the apathy we have to bring about in ourselves to be equal to the task of understanding our subject, nor are we striving to make our interpretive interventions take on the oracular quality that they must possess against this backdrop of inertia. We wish to avoid the trap hidden in the appeal marked by faith's eternal pathos the patient addresses to us. It harbors a secret within itself. Take upon yourself, he tells us, the suffering that weighs so heavily on my shoulders. But I can see that you are far too content, composed, and comfortable to be worthy of bearing it. What appears here is the arrogant affirmation of one's suffering will show its face. And sometimes at a moment decisive enough to give rise to the kind of negative therapeutic reaction that attracted Freud's attention in the form of the resistance of amor propre, love something, to use the term in all the depth given it by La Rochefoucauld, which is often expressed thus: I can't bear the thought of being freed by anyone but myself. Of course, due to a more unfathomable heartfelt exigency, the patient expects us to share in his pain. But we take our cue from his holistic, hostile reaction, which already made Freud wary of any temptation to play the prophet. Only saints are sufficiently detached from the deepest of our shared passions to avoid the aggressive repercussions of charity. As for presenting our own virtues and merits as examples, the only person I have ever known to resort to that was some big boss, thoroughly imbued with the idea, as austere as it was innocent, of his own apostolic, oh my goodness, apostolic value, I still recall the fury he unleashed. In any case, such reactions should hardly surprise us analysts, who expose the aggressive motives behind all so-called philanthropic activity. We must nevertheless bring out the subject's aggressiveness toward us, because, as we know, aggressive intentions form the negative transference that is the inaugural knot of the analytic drama. This phenomenon represents the patient's imaginary transference onto us of one of the more or less archaic imagos, which degrades, diverts, or inhibits the cycle of a certain behavior by an effective symbolic subduction, which has excluded a certain function or body part from the ego's control by an accident of repression, which has given its form to this or that agency of the personality through an act of identification. It can be seen that the most incidental pretext is enough to arouse an aggressive intention that reactualizes the imago, which has remained pertinent at the level of symbolic overdetermination that we call the subject's unconscious, along with its intentional correlate. Such a mechanism often proves to be extremely simple in hysteria, in the case of a girl afflicted with astasia abasia, which for months had resisted the most varied forms of therapeutic suggestion. I was immediately identified with a constellation of the most unpleasant features that the object of a passion formed for her. A passion marked, moreover, by a fairly strong delusional tone. The underlying imago was that of her father, and it was enough for me to remark that she had not had his support, a lack which I knew had dominated her biography in a highly fanciful manner. For her to be cured of her symptom without, it might be said, it might be said, her having understood anything or her morbid of wait, her having understood anything or her morbid passion having in any way been affected. Such knots are, as we know, more difficult to untie in obsessive neurosis, precisely because of the well-known fact that its structure is particularly designed to camouflage, displace, deny, divide, and muffle aggressive intentions. It does so by a defense decomposition that is so similar in its principles to that illustrated by the stepping and staggering technique that a number of my patients have themselves employed military fortification metaphors to describe themselves. As to the role of aggressive intention in phobia, it is, as it were, manifest. Thus, it is not inadvisable to reactivate such an intention in psychoanalysis. What we try to avoid in our technique is to allow the patient's aggressive intention to find support in a current idea about us that is well enough developed for it to become organized in such reactions as opposition, negation, ostentation, and lying that our experience has shown to be characteristic modes of the agency known as the ego in dialogue. I am characterizing this agency here, not by the theoretical construction Freud gives of it in his metapsychology, that is, as the perception consciousness system, but what he recognized as the ego's most constant phenomenological essence in analytic experience, namely vernanal negation, urging us to detect its presence in the most general index of an inversion owing to a prior judgment. In short, by ego, I designate the nucleus that, in short, by nu ego, I designate one, the nucleus given to consciousness, though it is opaque to reflection, that is marked by all the ambiguities which, from self-indulgence to bad faith, structure the human subject's lived experience of the passions. Two, the I that, while exposing its facticity to existential criticism, opposes its irreducible inertia of pretenses and misrecognition to the concrete problematic of the subject's realization. Far from attacking it head on, the analytic maieutic takes a detour that amounts, in the end, to inducing in the subject a guided paranoia. Indeed, one aspect of analytic action is to bring about the projection of what Melanie Klein calls bad internal objects, which is a paranoiac mechanism, certainly. But in this context, it is highly systematized, in some sense filtered, and properly checked. This is the aspect of our praxis that corresponds to the category of space, provided we include in it the imaginary space in which the dimension of symptoms develops, which structures them like excluded islets, inert scotomas, or parasitic autonomies, or parasitic autonomisms in the person's functioning. Corresponding to the other dimension, the temporal is anxiety and its impact, whether patent as in the phenomenon or flight or inhibition, or latent as when it only appears with the ego that arouses it. Again, let me repeat, this imago reveals itself only to the extent that our attitude offers the subject the pure mirror of a smooth surface. To understand what I'm saying here, imagine what would happen if a patient saw in his analyst an exact replica of himself. Everyone senses that the patient's excess of aggressive tensions would prove such an obstacle to the manifestation of transference that its useful effect could only be brought about very slowly. And this is what happens in certain training analyses. If we imagine it in the extreme sense, experience in the uncanny form of characteristic of the apprehensions of one's double, the situation would trigger uncontrollable anxiety. Thesis 4. Aggressiveness is the tendency correlated with a mode of identification I call narcissistic, which determines the formal structure of man's ego and of the register of entities characteristic of his world. The subjective experience of analysis immediately inscribes its results in concrete psychology. Let me simply indicate here what it contributes to the psychology of the emotions when it demonstrates the meaning common to states as diverse as phantasmatic fear, anger, active sorrow, and psychoasthenic fatigue. To shift now from the subjectivity of intention to the notion of a tendency to aggress is to make a leap from the phenomenology of our experience to metapsychology. But this leap manifests nothing more than a requirement of our thought, which, in order now to objectify the register of aggressive reactions, given our inability to seriate to accord it according to its quantitative variations, must include it in a formula of equivalence. That is what we do with the notion of libido. The aggressive tendency proves to be fundamental in a certain series of significant personality states, namely the paranoid and paranoiac psychoses. In my work, I have emphasized that there is a correlation, due to their strictly parallel seriation, between the quality of aggressive reaction to be expected from a particular form of paranoia and the stage of mental genesis represented by the delusion that is symptomatic of that form. The correlation appears even more profound when the aggressive act dissolves the delusional construction. I have shown this in the case of a curable form, self-punishing paranoia. Thus, aggressive reactions form a continuous series from the violent, unmotivated outburst of the act through the whole range of belligerent forms and to the cold war of interpretive demonstrations. This series parallels another, that of imputations of harm, the explanations for which, without mentioning the obscure kakon, to which the paranoiac attributes his discordance with all living things, run the gamut from poison, borrowed from the register of a highly primitive organism, to evil spells, magic, influence, telepathy, physical intrusion, lesions, diversion of intent, abuse, theft of secrets, dispossession, violation of privacy, profanation, injury, legal action, spying and intimidation, persecution, defamation and character assassination, prestige, and damages and exploitation claims. I've shown that in each case, this series, in which we find all the successive envelopes of the person's biological and social status, is based on an original organization of ego and object forms that are also structurally affected thereby, even down to the spatial and temporal categories in which the ego and the object are constituted. The latter are experienced as events in a perspective of mirages, as affections, with something stereotypical about them that suspends their dialectical movement. Janae, who so admirably demonstrated the signification of feelings of persecution as phenomenological moments of social behaviors, do not explore their common characteristic, which is precisely that they are constituted by stagnation in one of these moments, similar in strangeness to the faces of actors when a film is suddenly stopped in mid-frame. Now, this formal stagnation is akin to the most general structure of human knowledge, which constitutes the ego and objects as having the attributes of permanence, identity, and substance. In short, as entities or things that are very different from the gestalts that experience enables us to isolate in the mobility of the field constructed according to the lines of animal desire. Indeed, this formal fixation, which introduces a certain difference of level, a certain discordance between man as organism and his Umwelt, is very condition. It is the very condition that indefinitely extends his world and his power by giving his objects their instrumental polyvalence and symbolic polyphony, as well as their potential as weaponry. What I called paranoid knowledge is therefore shown to correspond in its more or less archaic forms to certain critical moments that punctuate the history of man's mental genesis, each representing a stage of objectifying identification. We can glimpse its stages in children by simple observation, in which Charlotte Buhler, Elsa Koehler, and following in their footsteps, the Chicago School have revealed several levels of significant manifestations, though only analytic experience can give them their exact value by making it possible to reintegrate subjective relations in them. The first level shows us that the very young child's experience of himself or of itself, insofar as it is related to the child's semblable, develops on the basis of a situation that is experienced as undifferentiated. Thus, around the age of 8 months, in confrontations between children, which, if they are to be fruitful, must be between children whose difference in age is no more than 2.5 months, we see gestures of fictitious actions by which one subject renews the other's imperfect gesture, by confusing their distinct application and synchronies of spectacular capture that are all the more remarkable as they precede the complete coordination of the motor systems they involve. Thus, the aggressiveness that is manifested in the retaliations of slaps and blows cannot be regarded as a playful manifestation of the exercise of strength and their employment in getting to know the body. It must be understood within a broader realm of coordination, one that will subordinate the functions of tonic postures and vegetative tension to a social relativity whose prevalence in the expressive constitution of human emotions has been remarkably well emphasized by Wallon. Furthermore, I believed I myself could highlight the fact that on such occasions the child anticipates at the mental level the conquest of his own body's functional unity, which is still incomplete to level of volitional motricity at that point in time. What we have here is a first capture by the image in which the first moment of the dialectic of identifications is sketched out. It is linked to a gestalt phenomenon, the child's very early perception of the human form, a form which, as we know, holds the child's interest right from the first months of life and, in the case of the human face, right from the 10th day. But what demonstrates the phenomenon of recognition, implying subjectivity, are the signs of triumphant jubilation and the playful self-discovery that characterize the child's encounter with his mirror image starting in the 6th month. This behavior contrasts sharply with the indifference shown by the very animals that perceive this image. The chimpanzee, for example, once they have tested its vanity as an object, and it is even more noteworthy as it occurs at an age when the child lags behind the chimpanzee in instrumental intelligence, only catching up with the latter at 11 months of age. What we have called the mirror stage is of interest because it manifests the affective dynamism by which the subject primordially identifies with the visual gestalt of his own body, in comparison with the still very profound lack of coordination in his own mode of functioning. That gestalt is an ideal unity, a salutary imago. Its value is heightened by all the early distress resulting from the child's intra-organic and relational discordance during the first 6 months of life, when he bears the neurological humoral signs of a physiological prematurity at birth. It is this capture by the image of the human form, rather than ein Fervel, the absence of which is abundantly clear in early childhood, that dominates the whole dialectic of the child's behavior in the presence of his semblable between 6 months and 2.5 years of age. Throughout this period, one finds emotional reactions and articulated evidence of a normal transitivism. A child who beats another child says that he himself was beaten. A child who sees another child fall cries. Similarly, it is by identifying with the other that he experiences the whole range of bearing and display reactions, whose structural ambivalence is clearly revealed in his behaviors. The slave identifying with the despot, the actor with the spectator, the seduced with the seducer. There is a sort of structural crossroads here to which we must accommodate our thinking if we are to understand the nature of aggressiveness in man and its relation to the formalism of his ego and objects. It is in this erotic relationship in which the human individual fixates on an image that alienates him from himself, that we find the energy and the form from which the organization of the passions that he will call his ego originates. Indeed, this form crystallizes in the subject's inner conflictual tension, which leads to the awakening of his desire for the object of the other's desire. Here the primordial confluence precipitates into aggressive competition, from which develops the triad of other people, ego and object, spangling the space of spectacular communion. This triad is inscribed there according to its own formalism, and it so completely dominates the effect of ein Fervel that a child at that age may not recognize the people he knows best if they appear in completely different surroundings. But if the ego seems to be marked, right from the outset, by this aggressive relativity, which minds starved for objectivity might equate with an animal's emotional erections, when it is distracted by a desire in the course of its experimental conditioning, how can we escape the conclusion that each great instinctual metamorphosis punctuating the individual's life throws its delimitation back into question. Composed as it is of the conjunction of the subject's history with the unthinkable innateness of his desire. This is why man's ego is never reducible to his lived identity, except at a limit that even the greatest geniuses have never been able to approach, and why in the depressive disruptions constituted by reversals experienced due to a sense of inferiority, the ego essentially engenders deadly negations that freeze it in its formalism. What happens to me has nothing to do with what I am. There's nothing about you that is worthwhile. Thus the two moments, when the subject negates himself and when he accuses the other, become indistinguishable, and we see here the paranoid structure of the ego that finds its analogue in the fundamental negations highlighted by Freud in the three delusions, jealousy, erotomania, and interpretation. It is the very delusion of the misanthropic beautiful soul, casting out onto the world the disorder that constitutes his being. Subjective experience must be fully accredited if we are to recognize the central knot of ambivalent aggressiveness, which at the present stage of our culture is given to us in the dominant form of resentment, including even its most archaic aspects in the child. Thus Saint Augustine, because he lived at a similar time without having to suffer from a behaviorist resistance, in the sense in which I use the term, foreshadowed psychoanalysis by giving us an exemplary image of such behavior in the following terms. I myself have seen and known an infant to be jealous, even though it could not speak. It became pale and cast bitter looks onto its foster brother. Thus Augustine forever ties the situation of spectacular absorption, the child observed, the emotional reaction, pale, and the reactivation of images of primordial frustration with an envenomed look, which are the psychical and somatic coordinates of the earliest aggressiveness to the infant, pre-verbal stage of early childhood. Only Melanie Klein, studying children on the verge of language, dared to project subjective experiences into that earlier period. Observation, nevertheless, enables us to affirm its role there in the simple fact, for example, that a child who does not yet speak reacts differently to punishment than to brutality. Through Klein, we have become aware of the function of the imaginary primordial enclosure formed by the imago of the mother's body. Through her, we have the mapping, drawn by children's own hands, of the mother's inner empire, and the historical atlas of the internal divisions in which the imagos of the father and siblings, whether real or virtual, and the subject's own voracious aggression, dispute their deleterious hold over her sacred regions. We have also become aware of the persistence in the subject of the shadow of bad internal objects related to some accidental association, to use a term concerning which we should emphasize the organic meaning analytic experience gives it, as opposed to the abstract meaning it retains from Humean ideology. Hence we can understand by what structural means re-evoking certain imaginary personae and producing certain situation inferiorities may disconcert the adult's voluntary functions in the most rigorously predictable way, namely by the fragmenting imago impact on the imago involved in the earliest identification. By showing us the primordial nature of the depressive position, the extremely archaic subjectification of a kakon, Melanie Klein pushes back the limits within which we can see the subjective function of identification at work, and she especially enables us to situate the first superego formation as extremely rare, as extremely early. But it is important to delimit the orbit within which the following relations, some of which have yet to be elucidated, are situated in our theoretical work. Guilt tension, oral harmfulness, hypochondriacal fixation, not to mention primordial masochism, which I am excluding from my remarks here, in order to isolate the notion of an aggressiveness linked to the narcissistic relationship and to the structures of systematic misrecognition and objectification that characterize ego formation. A specific satisfaction based on the integration of an original organic chaos corresponds to the urbild of this formation, alienating as it may be due to its function of rendering foreign. This satisfaction must be conceived of in the dimension of a vital dehiscence constitutive of man, and makes unthinkable the idea of an environment that is performed for him. It is a negative libido that enables the Heraclitian notion of discord, which the Ephesian held to be prior to harmony, to shine once more. Thus, there is no need to look any further to find the source of the energy that the ego borrows to put in the service of the reality principle, a question Freud raises regarding repression. This energy indubitably comes from narcissistic passion, provided one conceives of the ego according to the subjective notion I am proposing here as consonant with the register of analytic experience. The theoretical difficulties encountered by Freud seem, in fact, to stem from the mirage of objectification inherited from classical psychology, constituted by the idea of the perception consciousness system, in which the existence of everything the ego neglects, schematizes, and misrecognizes in the sensations that make it react to reality, and of everything it doesn't know, exhausts and ties down in the meanings it receives from language, suddenly seem to be overlooked, a surprising oversight on the part of the man who succeeded in forcing open the borders of the unconscious with the power of his dialectic. Just as the superego's insane oppression lies at the root of the well-founded imperatives of moral conscience, mad passion, specific to man, stamping his image on reality, is the obscure foundation of the will's rational mediations. The notion of aggressiveness as a tension related with narcissistic structure in the subject's becoming allows us to encompass in a very simply formulated function all sorts of accidents and atypicalities in that becoming. I shall indicate here how I conceive of its dialectical link with the function of the Oedipus complex. In its normal function, its function is that of sublimation, which precisely designates an identificatory reshaping of the subject and, as Freud wrote when he felt the need for a topographical coordination of psychical dynamisms, a secondary identification by introjection of the image of the parent of the same sex. The energy for that identification is provided by the first biological surge of genital libido, but it is clear that the structural effect of identification with a rival is not self-evident, except at the level of fable, and can only be conceptualized if the way is paved for it by a primary identification that structures the subject as rivaling with himself. In fact, a note of biological impotence is met with again here, as is the effect of anticipation characteristic of the human psyche's genesis, in the fixation of an imaginary ideal which, as analysis has shown, determines whether or not the instinct conforms to the individual's physiological sex. A point, let it be said in passing, whose anthropological import cannot be too highly stressed. But what interests me here is what I shall refer to as the pacifying function of the ego ideal, the connection between its libidinal normativeness and a cultural normativeness bound up since the dawn of history with the imago of the father. Here, obviously, lies the import that Freud's work, Totem and Taboo, still has despite the mythical circularity that vitiates it, insofar as from a mythical event, the killing of the father, it derives the subjective dimension that gives his event this event its meaning, guilt. Indeed, Freud shows us that the need for a form of participation which neutralizes the conflict inscribed after killing him in the situation of rivalry among the brothers is the basis for identification with the paternal totem. Oedipal identification is thus the identification by which the subject transcends the aggressiveness constitutive of the first subjective individuation. I've stressed elsewhere that it constitutes a step in the establishment of the distance by which, with feelings akin to respect, a whole affective assumption of one's fellow man is brought about. Only the anti-dialectical mentality of a culture which, dominated as it is by objectifying ends, tends to reduce all subjective activity to the ego's being, can justify von den Steinen's astonishment when confronted by Barrow, who said, "I'm an Ara." All the primitive mind sociologists scurry about trying to fathom this profession of identity, which is no more surprising upon reflection than declaring "I'm a doctor" or "I'm a citizen of the French Republic," and certainly presents fewer logical difficulties than claiming "I'm a man," which at most can mean no more than "I'm like the person who, in recognizing him to be a man, I constitute as someone who can recognize me as a man." In the final analysis, these various formulations can be understood only in reference to the truth of "I is an other," less dazzling to the poet's intuition than it is obvious from the psychoanalyst's viewpoint. Who, if not us, will call back into question the objective status of this I, which a historical evolution peculiar to our culture tends to confuse with the subject. The specific impact of this anomaly on every level of language deserves to be displayed, and first and foremost, as regards the first person as grammatical subject in our languages, the love, the hypostases, a tendency in a subject who denies it, an impossible mirage in linguistic forms, among which the most ancient are to be found, and in which the subject appears fundamentally in the position of a determinative or instrumental of the character. Let us not pursue here the critique of all the abuses of the cogito ergo sum, recalling instead that, in analytic experience, the ego represents the center of all resistances to the treatment of symptoms. It was inevitable that analysis, after emphasizing the reintegration of tendencies excluded by the ego, those tendencies underlying the symptoms it tackled at first, most of which were related to failed Oedipal identification, should eventually discover the moral dimension of the problem. Parallel to that, what came to the fore were, on the one hand, the role played by the aggressive tendencies in the structure of symptoms and personality, and on the other, all sorts of uplifting conceptions of the liberated libido, one of the first of which can be attributed to French psychoanalysts under the heading of oblativity. It is, in fact, clear that genital libido operates by blindly going beyond the individual for the sake of the species, and that its sublimating effects in the Oedipal crisis are at the root of the whole process of man's cultural subordination. Nevertheless, one cannot overemphasize the irreducible character of narcissistic structure and the ambiguity of a notion that tends to misrecognize the constancy of aggressive tension in all moral life that involves subjection to this structure. For no amount of oblativity could free altruism from it. This is why La Rochefoucauld could formulate his maxim, in which his rigor concurs with the fundamental theme of his thought on the incompatibility between marriage and delight. We would be allowing the cutting edge of analytic experience to become dull if we deluded ourselves, if not our patients, into believing in some sort of pre-established harmony that would free social conformity, made possible by the reduction of symptoms, of its tendency to induce aggressiveness in the subject. Theoreticians in the Middle Ages showed a rather different kind of penetration when they debated whether love could be understood in terms of a physical theory or an ecstatic theory, both of which involved the reabsorption of man's ego, the one by its reintegration into a universal good, the other by the subject's effusion toward an object devoid of alterity. In all of an individual's genetic phases, and it's at every degree of a person's human accomplishment, we find this narcissistic moment in the subject, in a before in which he must come to terms with the libidinal frustration, and in an after in which he transcends himself in a normative sublimation. This conception allows us to understand the aggressiveness involved in the effects of all the subject's regressions, aborted undertakings, and refusals of typical development, especially at the level of sexual realization. And more precisely, within each of the great phases that the libidinal metamorphosis bring about in human life, whose major function analysis has demonstrated, weaning, the Oedipal stage, puberty, maturity, and motherhood, not to mention the involutional climacteric. I've often said that the emphasis initially placed in psychoanalytic doctrine on the Oedipal conflicts, aggressive retortions in the subject, correspond to the fact that the effects of the complex were first glimpsed in failed attempts to resolve it. There is no need to emphasize that a coherent theory of the narcissistic phase clarifies the ambivalence peculiar to the partial drives of scotophilia, sadomasochism, and homosexuality, as well as the stereotypical ceremonial formalism of the aggressiveness that is manifested in them. I'm talking here often about the often barely realized apprehension of other people in the practice of certain of these perversions, their subjective value actually being very different from that ascribed to them in the otherwise very striking existential reconstructions Sartre provided. I should also like to mention in passing that the decisive function I ascribe to the image of one's own body in the determination of the narcissistic phase enables us to understand the clinical relation between congenital anomalies of functional lateralization, left-handedness, and all forms of inversion of sexual and cultural normalization. This reminds us of the role attributed to gymnastics in the beautiful and good ideal of education among the ancient Greeks, and leads us to the social thesis in which I will conclude. Thesis 5. This notion of aggressiveness as one of the intentional coordinates of the human ego, especially as regards the category of space, allows us to conceive of its role in modern neurosis and in the malaise in civilization. Here I want to merely sketch out a perspective regarding the verdicts analytic experience allows us to come to in the present social order. The preeminence of aggressiveness in our civilization would already be sufficiently demonstrated by the fact that it is usually confused in everyday morality with the virtue of strength. Quite rightly understood as indicative of ego development, aggressiveness is regarded as indispensable in a social practice and is so widely accepted in our mores that, in order to appreciate its cultural peculiarity, one must become imbued with the meaning and efficient virtues of a practice like that of Yang in the public and private morality of the Chinese. Were it not superfluous, the prestige of the idea of the struggle for life would be sufficiently attested to by the success of a theory that was able to make us endorse a notion of selection based solely on the animal's conquest of space as a valid explanation for the developments of life. Indeed, Darwin's success seems to derive from the fact that he projected the predations of Victorian society and the economic euphoria that sanctioned for that society, the social devastation that it initiated on a planetary scale, and that he justified its predations with the image of a laissez-faire system in which the strongest predators compete for their natural prey. Before Darwin, however, Hegel had provided the definitive theory of the specific function of aggressiveness in human ontology, seeming to prophesy the iron law of our own time. From the conflicts between master and slave, he deduced the entire subjective and objective progress of our history, revealing in its crises the syntheses represented by the highest forms of the status of the person in the West, from the Stoic to the Christian, and even to the future citizen of the universal state. Here, the natural individual is regarded as nil, since the human subject is nothing in effect before the absolute master that death is for him. The satisfaction of human desire is possible only when mediated by the other's desire and labor, while it is the recognition of man by man that is at stake in the conflict between master and slave. This recognition is based on a radical negation of natural values, whether expressed in the master's sterile tyranny or the work's productive sterile tyranny or in work's productive tyranny. The support this profound doctrine lent to the slave's constructive Spartacism, recreated by the barbarity of the Darwinian century, is well known. The relativization of our sociology by the scientific collection of the cultural forms we are destroying in the world, and the analyses bearing truly psychoanalytic marks, in which Plato's wisdom shows us the dialectic common to the passions of the soul and of the city, can enlighten us as to the reason for this barbarity, namely, to employ the jargon that corresponds to our approaches to man's subjective needs, the increasing absence of all the saturations of the superego and ego ideal that occur in all kinds of organic forms in traditional societies. Forms that extend from the rituals of everyday intimacy to the periodical festivals in which the community manifests itself. We no longer know them except in their most obviously degraded guises. Furthermore, in abolishing the cosmic polarity of the male and female principles, our society is experiencing the full psychological impact of the modern phenomenon known as the battle of the sexes. Ours is an immense community, midway between a democratic anarchy of the passions and their hopeless leveling out by the great winged drone of narcissistic tyranny. It is clear that the promotion of the ego in our existence is leading in conformity with the utilitarian conception of man that reinforces it, to an ever greater realization of man as an individual, in other words, in an isolation of the soul that is ever more akin to its original dereliction. Correlatively, it seems, I mean for reasons whose historical contingency is based on a necessity that certain of my considerations make it possible to perceive, we are engaged in a technological enterprise on the scale of the entire species. The question is whether the conflict between master and slave will find its solution in the service of the machine, which a psychotechnics is already yielding a rich harvest of ever more precise applications, will strive to provide race car drivers and guards for regulating power stations. The notion of the role of spatial symmetry in man's narcissistic structure is essential in laying the groundwork for a psychological analysis of space, whose space I can merely indicate here. Animal psychology has shown us. Was very rudely just interrupted by a phone call. So I don't know where the fuck I was. So I'm just going to read this part. The notion of the role of spatial symmetry in man's narcissistic structure is essential in laying the groundwork for a psychological analysis of space, whose place I can merely indicate here. Animal psychology has shown us that the individual's relation to a particular spatial field is socially mapped in certain species, in a way that raises it to the category of subjective membership. I would say that it is the subjective possibility of the mirror projection of such a field into the other's field that gives human space its originality, geometrical structure, a structure I would willingly categorize as kaleidoscopic. Such, at least, is the space in which the imagery of the ego develops and which intersects the objective space of reality. But does it provide us a secure basis already in the Lebensraum, living space, in which human competition grows ever keener? An observer of our species from outer space will conclude we possess needs to escape with very odd results. But doesn't conceptualize extension, to which we believed we had reduced reality, later seem to refuse to lend its support to the physicist's thinking. Having extended our grasp to the furthest reaches of matter, won't this realized space, which makes the great imaginary spaces in which the free games of the ancient sages roamed seem illusory to us, thus vanish in turn in a roar of the universal ground? Whatever the case may be, we know how our adaptation to these exigencies proceeds, and that war is increasingly proving to be the inevitable and necessary midwife of all our organizational progress. The adaptation of adversaries opposed in their social systems certainly seem to be progressing toward a confluence of forms, but one may well wonder whether it is motivated by agreement as to their necessity, or by the kind of identification Dante in the Inferno depicts in the image of a deadly kiss. Moreover, it doesn't seem that the human individual, as the material for such a struggle, is absolutely flawless, and the detection of bad internal objects, responsible for reactions that may prove extremely costly in terms of equipment, of inhibition and headlong flight, which we have recently learned to use in the selection of shock, fighter, parachute and commando troops, proves that war, after having taught us a great deal about the genesis of the neuroses, is perhaps proving too demanding in its need for ever more neutral subjects to serve an aggression in which feeling is undesirable. Nevertheless, we have a few psychological truths to contribute here, namely, the extent to which the ego's supposed instinct of self-preservation willingly gives way before the temptation to dominate space, and above all, the extent to which the fear of death, the absolute master, presumed to exist in consciousness by a whole philosophical tradition from Hegel onward, is psychologically subordinate to the narcissistic fear of harm to one's own body. I do not think it was futile to have highlighted the relation between the spatial dimension and a subjective tension, which, in the malaise of civilization, intersects with the tension of anxiety, approached so humanely by Freud, and which develops in the temporal dimension. I would willingly shed light on the latter, too, using the contemporary significations of two philosophies that would seem to correspond to the philosophies I just mentioned, that of Bergson, owing to its naturalistic inadequacy, and that of Kierkegaard, owing to its dialectical signification. Only at the intersection of these two tensions should one envisage the assumption by man of his original fracturing, by which it might be said that at a very instant He constitutes his world by committing suicide, and the psychological experience of which Freud had the audacity to formulate as the death instinct, however paradoxical its expression in biological terms may be. In the emancipated man of modern society, this fracturing reveals that his formidable crack goes right to the very depths of his being. It is a self-punishing neurosis with hysterical hypochondriacal symptoms of its functional inhibitions, psychoasthenic forms of its derealizations of other people and of the world, and its social consequences of failure and crime. It is this touching victim, this innocent escapade, who has thrown off the shackles that condemn modern man to the most formidable hell, social hell, whom we take in when he comes to us. It is this being of nothingness for whom, in our daily task, we clear anew the path to his meaning in a discrete fraternity, a fraternity to which we never measure up. The mirror stage as formative of the I function, as revealed in psychoanalytic experience. Delivered on July 17, 1949, in Zurich, at the 16th International Congress of Psychoanalysis. The conception of the mirror stage I introduced at our last Congress 13 years ago, having since been more or less adopted by the French group, seems worth bringing to your attention once again, especially today, given the light it sheds on the I function and the experience psychoanalysis provides us of it. It should be noted that this experience sets us at odds with any philosophy directly stemming from the cogito. Some of you may recall the behavioral characteristic I begin with that is explained by a fact of comparative psychology. The human child, at an age when he is for a short while, but for a while nonetheless, outdone by the chimpanzee in instrumental intelligence, can already recognize his own image as such in a mirror. This recognition is indicated by the illuminative mimicry of the Aha Urbanis, which Köhler considers to express situational apperception, an essential moment in the act of intelligence. Indeed, this act, far from exhausting itself, as in the case of a monkey, in eventually acquired control over the uselessness of the image, immediately gives rise in a child to a series of gestures in which he playfully experiences the relationship between the movements made in the image and the reflected environment, and between this virtual complex and the reality it duplicates, namely, the child's own body and the persons, even things around him. This event can take place, as we know from Baldwin's work, from the age of 6 months on. Its repetition has often given me pause to reflect upon the striking spectacle of a nursling in front of a mirror who has not yet mastered walking or even standing, but who, though held tightly by some prop, human or artificial, what in France we call a trot bébé, a sort of walker, overcomes, in a flutter of jubilant activity, the constraints of his prop in order to adopt a slightly leaning forward position and take in an instantaneous view of the image in order to fix it in his mind. In my view, this activity has a specific meaning up to the age of 18 months and reveals both a libidinal dynamism that has hitherto remained problematic and an ontological structure of the human world that fits in with my reflections on paranoid knowledge. It suffices to understand the mirror stage in this context as an identification and the full sense analysis gives to the term, namely, the transformation that takes place in the subject when he assumes an image that is seemingly predestined to have an effect at this phase, as witnessed by the use in analytic theory of antiquity's term imago. the jubilant assumption of his specular image by the kind of being still trapped in his motor impotence and nursling dependence. The little man is at the infant stage, thus seems to me to manifest in an exemplary situation the symbolic matrix in which the I is precipitated in a primordial form, prior to being objectified in the dialectic of identification with the other, and before language restores to it, in the universal, its function as subject. This form would, moreover, have to be called the ideal I, if we wanted to translate it into a familiar register, in the sense that it will also be the rootstock of secondary identifications, this latter term subsuming the libidinal normalization functions. But the important point is that this form situates the agency known as the ego prior to its social determination in a fictional direction that will forever remain irreducible for any single individual, or rather, that will only asymptotically approach the subject's becoming, no matter how successful the dialectical syntheses by which he must resolve as I his discordance with his own reality. For the total form of this of his body, by which the subject anticipates the maturation of his power in an imp in a mirage, is given to him only as a gestalt, that is, in an exteriority in which, to be sure, this form is more constitutive than constituted, but in which, above all, it appears to him as the contour of his stature that freezes it, and in a symmetry that reverses it, in opposition to the turbulent movements with which the subject feels he animates it. Through these two aspects of its appearance, this gestalt, whose power should be considered linked to the species, though its motor style is as yet unrecognizable, symbolizes the I's mental permanence at the same time as it prefigures its alienating destination. This gestalt is also replete with the correspondences that unite the I with the statue onto which man projects himself, the phantoms that dominate him, and the automaton with which the world of his making tends to achieve fruition in an ambiguous relation. Indeed, for imagos, whose veiled faces we analysts see emerge in our daily experience and in the penumbra of symbolic effectiveness, the specular image seems to be the threshold of the visible world. If we take into account the mirrored disposition of the imago of one's own body in hallucinations and dreams, whether it involves one's individual features or even one's infirmities or object projections, or if we take note of the role of the mirror apparatus in the appearance of doubles, in which psychical realities manifest themselves that are, moreover, heterogeneous. The fact that a gestalt may have formative effects on an organism is attested to by a biological experiment that is so far removed from the idea of psychical causality that it cannot bring itself to formulate itself in such terms. The experiment, nevertheless, acknowledges that it is a necessary condition for the maturation of the female pigeon's gonad that the pigeon see another member of its species, regardless of its sex. This condition is so utterly sufficient that the same effect may be obtained by merely placing a mirror's reflective field near the individual. Similarly, in the case of the migratory locust, the shift within a family line from the solitary to the gregarious form can be brought about by exposing an individual, at a certain stage of its development, to the exclusively visual action of an image akin to its own, provided the movements of this image sufficiently resemble those characteristic of its species. Such facts fall within a realm of homeomorphic identification that is itself subsumed within the question of the meaning of beauty is formative and erogenous. But mimetic facts, understood as heteromorphic identification, are of just as much interest to us insofar as they raise the question of the signification of space for living organisms. Psychological concepts hardly seeming less appropriate for shedding light here than the ridiculous attempts made to reduce these facts to the supposedly supreme law of adaptation. We need but recall how Roger K. Loy, still young and fresh from his break with the sociological school at which he trained, illuminated the subject when, with the term legendary psychasthenia, he subsumed morphological mimicry within the derealizing effect of an obsession with space. As I myself have shown, human knowledge is more independent than animal knowledge from the force field of desire, because of the social dialectic that structures human knowledge as paranoiac, and what limits it is the scant reality surrealistic unsatisfaction denounces therein. These reflections lead me to recognize in the spatial capture, manifested by the mirror stage, the effect in man, even prior to this social dialectic, of an organic inadequacy of his natural reality. Assuming we can give some meaning to the word nature. The function of the mirror stage thus turns out, in my view, to be a particular case of the function of imagos, which is to establish a relationship between an organism and its reality, or as they say, between the Innenwelt and the Umwelt. In man, however, this relationship to nature is altered by a certain dehiscence at the heart, the very heart of the organism, a primordial discord betrayed by the signs of malaise and motor uncoordination of the neonatal months. The objective notions of the anatomical incompleteness of the pyramidal tracts and of certain humoral residues of the maternal organism and the newborn confirm my view that we find a man in a veritable specific prematurity of birth. Let us note in passing that this fact is recognized as such by embryologists under the heading fetalization, as determining the superiority of the so-called higher centers of the central nervous system, and especially the cerebral cortex, which psychosurgical operations will lead us to regard as the intra-organic mirror. This development is experienced as a temporal dialectic that decisively projects the individual's formation into history. The mirror stage is a drama whose internal pressure pushes precipitously from insufficiency to anticipation, and for the subject caught up in the lure of spatial identification, turns out fantasies that proceed from a fragmented image of the body to what I will call an orthopedic form of its totality, and to the finally donned armor of an alienating identity that will mark his entire mental development with its rigid structure. Thus, the shattering of the Innenwelt to Umwelt circle gives rise to an inexhaustible squaring of the ego's orbits. This fragmented body, another expression I have gotten accepted into the French school's system of theoretical references, is regularly manifested in dreams when the movement of an analysis reaches a certain level of aggressive disintegration of the individual. It then appears in the form of disconnected limbs or of organs exoscopically represented, growing wings and taking up arms for internal persecutions that the visionary Hieronymus Bosch fixed for all time in painting in their ascent in the 15th century to the imaginary zenith of modern man. But this form takes out to be tangible even at the organic level, and the lines of fragilization that define the hysteric's phantasmatic anatomy, which is manifested in schizoid and spasmodic symptoms. Correlatively, the eye formation is symbolized in dreams by a fortified camp or even a stadium, distributing between the arena within its walls and its outer border of gravel pits and marshes, two opposed fields of battle where the subject bogs down in his quest for the proud remote inner castle, whose form, sometimes juxtaposed in the same scenario, strikingly symbolizes the id. Similarly, though here in the mental space, we find fortified structures constructed, the metaphors for which arise spontaneously as if deriving from the subject's very symptoms to designate the mechanisms of obsessive neurosis, inversion, isolation, reduplication, undoing what has been done, and displacement. But where I build on these subjective data alone, were I so, to so much as free them from the experiential condition that makes me view them as based on a language technique, my theoretical efforts would remain exposed to the charge of lapsing into the unthinkable, that of an absolute subject. This is why I have sought in the present hypothesis grounded in a confluence of objective data, a method of symbolic reduction as my guiding grid. It establishes a genetic order in ego defenses, in accordance with the wish formulated by Anna Freud in the first part of her major book, and situates, as against a frequently expressed prejudice, hysterical repression and its returns at a more archaic stage than obsessive inversion and its isolating processes. Situating the latter as prior to the paranoic alienation that dates back to the time at which the specular eye turns into the social eye. This moment at which the mirror stage comes to an end inaugurates, through identification with the image of one's semblable and the drama of primordial jealousy, so well brought out by the Charlotte Buhler school. In cases of transitivism in children, the dialectic that will henceforth link the eye to socially elaborated situations. It is this moment that decisively tips the whole of human knowledge into being mediated by the other's desire, constitutes its objects in an abstract equivalence due to competition from other people, and turns the eye into an apparatus to which every instinctual pressure consists a danger, constitutes a danger, even if it corresponds to a natural maturation process. The very normalization of this maturation is henceforth dependent in man on cultural intervention, as is exemplified by the fact that sexual object choice is dependent upon the Oedipus complex. In light of my conception, the term primary narcissism, by which analytic doctrine designates the libidinal investment characteristic of this moment, reveals in those who invented it a profound awareness of semantic latencies. Because it also sheds light on the dynamic opposition between this libido and sexual libido, an opposition they tried to define when they invoked destructive and even death instincts in order to explain the obvious relationship between narcissistic libido and the alienating I function, and the aggressiveness deriving therefrom in all relations with others, even in relations involving aid of the most good Samaritan variety. The fact is that they encountered the existential negativity, whose reality is so vigorously proclaimed by the contemporary philosophy of being and nothingness. Unfortunately, this philosophy grasps the negativity only within the limits of the self-sufficiency of consciousness, which, being one of its premises, ties the illusion of autonomy, in which it puts its faith, to the ego's constitutive misrecognitions. While it draws considerably on borrowings from psychoanalytic experience, this intellectual exercise culminates in the pretense of grounding in existential psychoanalysis. At the end of a society's historical enterprise, to learn no longer recognize that it has any but a utilitarian function. And given the individual's anxiety faced with the concentration camp form of the social link whose appearance seems to crown this effort, existentialism can be judged on the basis of the justifications it provides for the subjective impasses that do, indeed, result therefrom, a freedom that is never so authentically affirmed as when it is within the walls of a prison. A demand for commitment that expresses the inability of pure consciousness to overcome any situation, a voyeuristic, sadistic idealization of sexual relationships, a personality that achieves self-realization only in suicide, and a consciousness of the other that can only be satisfied by Hegelian murder. These notions are opposed by the whole of analytic experience, insofar as it teaches us not to regard the ego as centered on the perception consciousness system, or as organized by the reality principle, the expression of a scientific bias most hostile to the dialectic of knowledge, but rather, to take as our point of departure, the function of misrecognition that characterizes the ego in all the defense structures so forcefully articulated by Anna Freud. For while venal negation represents the blatant form of that function, its effects remain largely latent as long as they are not illuminated by some reflected light at the level of fate where the id manifests itself. The inertia characteristic of the I formations can thus be understood as providing the broadest definition of neurosis, just as the subject's capture by his situation gives us the most general formulation of madness, the kind found within the asylum walls as well as the kind that deafens the world with its sound and fury. The sufferings of neurosis and psychosis provide us schooling in the passions of the soul, just as the balance arm of the psychoanalytic scales, when we calculate the angle of its threat to entire communities, provides us with an amortization rate for the passions of the city. At this intersection of nature and culture, so obstinately scrutinized by the anthropology of our times, psychoanalysis alone recognizes the knot of imaginary servitude that love must always untie anew or sever. For such a task, we can find no promise in altruistic feeling. We who lay bare the aggressiveness that underlies the activities of the philanthropist, the idealist, the pedagogue, and even the reformer. In the subject-to-subject recourse we preserve, psychoanalysis can accompany the patient to the ecstatic limit of the thou art that, where the cipher of his mortal destiny is revealed to him. But it is not our sole power as practitioners to bring him to the point where the true journey begins.